Hello and welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am Cy Kellett, your host, and today we ask if it is possible to know the purpose of your life. And I don't mean to invent for yourself a purpose of your life or to construct a purpose of your life, but to discover and to know in the way that we know other things, to know with your power of reason what the purpose of your life is. Leo Severino is our guest. His new book is called Going Deeper, A Reasoned Exploration of God and Truth. Leo is a filmmaker. He was a lawyer and a philosopher trained at the University of Southern California, and he is the founder of Metanoia Films. He made the films Bella and Little Boy and continues to work on some very interesting projects to come out in the future. Leo Severino, thanks for joining us on Catholic Answers Focus.
Sai, thank you so much for having me. Thanks for all your good work. God bless you.
Thank you. Is it true that I can, by the power of reason, know the purpose of my life?
This is true. Not only is it knowable by the sheer light of reason, it's actually a tenet of our faith. It is part of my process of getting to this book was when I was a young philosophy wannabe coming out of university, and I had all these relativistic thoughts in my head and eventually started reasoning my way to the faith with the help of some amazing minds that have done this work before me in far better ways, including St. Thomas Aquinas. But one of the things that I thought I was, my brother and I, we went through the same process, and he is a smart kid. He went to Harvard and whatnot. And we were talking through one time, and we came to the conclusion, we're like, it's almost as if the purpose of life has something to do with God, like knowing him and doing what he would want. And we're like, yeah, you know. And my brother said, you know what, I think I've heard of that somewhere before. And I was like, no, we are geniuses. We made this up entirely on our own. We've just concluded this from the sheer power of our intellect. And it was like, cut to like a year later, we're both solidly devout in our Catholic faith. And wow. He's like, hey, turn to the Catechism, page one, and you'll see right there the purpose of life, right, as set forth by the Church. So it's knowable by reason, but also by revelation, as much as it's the deposit of faith. Many a Church father, theologian, and council has defined that our purpose is knowable and what that purpose is. And it's kind of, I think that's like chapter 14 of the book. So it takes a while to get there if you're just trying from a falling leaf to get to the purpose of life,
right.
You know?
Right. Start with that falling leaf. But you, what do you say then to the person? And we'll get to the falling leaf, because I think it's fascinating that you start with a very, very simple thing and reason to the purpose of your life. As a matter of fact, I think that's a wonderful thing. But the immediately, I think that the objection will be, well, that's your belief. And I think that that's going to be the objection, because whether that objection is reasonable or not, that's what people believe. There's some kind of, yeah. Oh, well, you know, that you're entitled to your belief.
Yes.
How do you respond to
that? And we should
examine
that. I've had much experience in responding to this, because not only was I there, plenty of my friends were there, and I've talked to many people that were there. And in fact, our culture is there. Pope Benedict the 16th Summaretus, he pointed out, and he coined the dictatorship of relativism. Relativism is exactly what you're pointing out, is that, you know, your experience is just your subjective experience. Your truth is your truth. My truth is my truth.
Yeah.
We have to live each other's truth, and there's nothing objective between a lot of us, because there's no objective truth, right? That's just your purpose. It's not my purpose, that sort of thing. Well, I start the book there, and it starts with this very notion, yeah, that there is no truth is very prevalent in this culture. And what I found out instantly when examining this, and what I would push on to all of your listeners, is this tidbit. If someone tells you there is no truth, you should immediately respond, is that true?
Right.
Because the second they say there is no truth, what they're really saying is, it is true that there is no truth. So that's the starting point.
It's a very clever response to say, well, if you say there is no truth, then you ask the person, is that true? Clearly, it cannot be true if it's, because it automatically falsifies itself. I wonder, okay, though, with many young people, maybe even older people too today, the next question will be then, or the next step will be, yeah, but you can't know that what you think is true is true. Why? Like, maybe that's true that somewhere there's something that's true, but you don't know the truth.
Right. And you should respond, do you know that? Do you know that we can't know the truth? Is it? No matter how they cut it, no matter how anyone tries to slice it, truth by its nature is simple. And we know that truth is God ultimately, right? So you're not going to be able to fight it and beat it. No matter how they formulate it, well, there's no such thing as an objective overall truth that is knowable. You just gave me an objective overall truth that is knowable, that there is no objective overall truth that is knowable. And you're saying you know that, right? So no matter how they try, always go back to the fact that there is a truth. And if it's truth by its nature, it's knowable, because that's what truth is. It's truth is that equation of thought to reality. And so, you know, that's the base position. From there to the purpose of life, like I said, is a bunch of steps, but there's a similar argument relative to the purpose, because once we say, well, there is truth, well, and it behooves us to find out what that truth is, I, in the book, go to what can we know to be absolutely certainly true?
Right.
And then eventually, like I was saying, there's an argument, if they bring up, if we get to the purpose of life, we can conclude, even without taking all these deductive steps, that life has a purpose. And if we have 2 minutes, I'll try to walk you through kind of what I set forth in the book. Is that all right, Si?
Heck yeah, we got 2 minutes for that. So I can, I didn't know you could do it in 2 minutes. I'm impressed, Leo. But you're a storyteller, so you got that skill. So you can walk me through logically and philosophically, and not relying on the Bible or any other kind of sacred text or tradition, to show me that life has a purpose.
I believe I can.
All right.
And I also, by the way, relying on the fact that this is a dogma of the faith, and relying on the fact that it is obviously true, I believe I can.
Okay.
And like I said, greater minds have done this in far greater ways, including St. Thomas Aquinas. My gift, hopefully, is to try to explain it in digestible, understandable ways. So here's an attempt at that. There's basically two possibilities. Either the universe is meaningless, or the universe has meaning. Either the universe is accidental, in which case it's just random and in that sense meaningless, or the universe is purposeful, that there is meaning to the universe, and not even talking about where we derive that meaning. Those are the two possibilities. And the one that's very prevalent is that this is random. This is an accidental universe. There's books that are titled by that, by very, very heady academic people, that there was nothing and then nothing somehow exploded. And even ignoring that part of it, over time, a bunch of stuff, matter at really, really high speeds, started coalescing and banging together and creating what we now call galaxies, and then eventually solar systems. And on one of these solar systems, by happenstance, the matter happened to form in such a way, with gravitational field and nuclear forces and whatnot, where this medium-sized star, there was a planet that was, you know, three rocks away from it, and that's Earth. And there was the conditions just right, just by pure probabilistic happenstance, for there to be this primordial ooze, and then lightning struck. And then out of this thing comes this, you know, single-celled whatever that eventually survived by, again, a bunch of random happenstances, to then be able to crawl about, and then eventually to crawl and walk upright, and then eventually to have a thought, and have that thought be knowable by itself, and to be conscious, right? That's kind of the story. The entire thing is a series of random accidents. Not even talking about evolution per se. Let's just take that as the base argument. Mm-hmm. Well, essentially what they're saying is the universe is meaningless. The universe is accidental and random. Because you can't get, I think the premise that we can't get meaning from accident, if you spilled Scrabble pieces on the floor and it said Kill Bill, you know, no one's going to be like, whoa, I'm going to go take a knife and kill my uncle, right? So if the universe is meaningless, well, then life is also meaningless. Life is a meaningless byproduct of a meaningless universe. Well, if life is meaningless, then thought is also meaningless, because thought is just a meaningless byproduct of a meaningless life that's a meaningless byproduct of a meaningless universe. But if thought is meaningless, then the very thought that life is meaningless is itself meaningless, and we have no reason to believe it. If we start with the premise that life is meaningless, what we're really saying is what I am saying has no meaning. What I'm saying has no purpose. All it is just atoms banging together accidentally, randomly, could have been otherwise, right? So that's kind of the way to say, listen, if you start with the premise that life is meaningless, what you're saying is the universe is meaningless, and then life is meaningless, which means all thought is meaningless, including the very thought that life is meaningless. That thought is also meaningless. It's purposeless. We should have no reason to say it. People who believe that life is meaningless, really, we should stop talking, because our words are all meaningless. They're just pebbles of sand on a beach washing into the ether, if you will.
Yeah, right.
So that argument is set forth in a more meticulous way in the book there. And then from there, to get to what that purpose is also a series of steps.
It sounds like one of the things that people are saying, like you hear this kind of, I don't know, easy atheism nowadays, where people just have no interest in God and all that kind of thing. But in doing that, they're making a certain set of assumptions that just cannot be reasonably sustained. It doesn't, in other words, Leo, I'm saying, I don't know that they're making reasoned arguments to their disinterest in God. They're making assumptions about the universe that if they would actually take the time to look at those assumptions, they cannot be reasonably sustained.
That's exactly right. Like there is no truth, or like life is meaningless, or like the universe is accidental. All those sorts of things, all they are is unexamined. All it takes is literally a few premises and a couple of logical conclusions to see past the smokescreen of those arguments.
And so that seems to me that's what you're doing here in this book. And I think Going Deeper is a great title for it. The idea is, if you have this kind of easy atheism, and I see the gray areas or something, and I have these deep thoughts about that there is no truth, and the fact is you need to just go deeper, and not deeper. You're not saying to people, although this is another option that will also work, I suppose, as well, go deeper into faith, but go deeper into your thinking. Think more deeply about this.
Well, in fact, I don't believe that faith and thinking are opposed.
Fair enough.
And I think, I'm not saying you're making that misconception, but it's very commonly held. I held it, right? The things of faith are relegated to the uneducated and the unacademics, the opiate of the masses, that sort of thing. That's one side of it. And the other side is, faith and thinking don't have to do with each other. And as much as what faith is when there is no evidence, when you can shut off your mind, even contrary to evidence, you still believe that is faith. I think neither one of those two extremes is actually very Catholic, right? We know that the Catholic position is that faith seeks understanding, because faith and reason, truth, are just two sides of the same coin, which is the truth that is God. One is knowable by just the sheer light of reasons, premises, conclusions, experiences. The other faith is known by grasping revealed truths. But it's all the continuum of the same truth, which is just one, and it's God. And this is why I wanted to do this book, go deeper in the sense of, let's not just be happy, let's do what St. Peter asked us to do, which is be able to present reasons for our faith. I mean, it's what Catholic Answers is all about, so you guys know well what I'm talking about.
Well, how concerned are you that the people who need the book, and I don't mean this flippantly, I mean that the people who need this book will not read it because they're comfortable in their assumptions? There is a kind of way to be comfortable as a materialist, at least while things are going well, in life.
Yeah.
Do you see what I'm saying? Like,
absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, it's the difficulty in writing a book like this, to reach an audience and then having, the people that are interested to promote it be people with the very title of Catholic Answers, right? Now, listen, the book is for Catholics, and it's most certainly for meant to buttress the faith that hopefully we all have, or for those who are nascent in their faith or who are doubting or whatnot. That's great. And I think that's the answer. I think these are the very people who have friends who might be agnostic or atheistic, or challenge them in their beliefs or whatever else. I think this is a great book that can be an evangelistic tool for those who have faith and say, oh, you're questioning me on this stuff. Hey, try this book. See if you can, if anything in this book answers some of those objections.
Indeed. And you do make a metaphysical argument for the existence of God, and then you make what I would call a natural law argument or a teleological argument for being able to know something about what that God intends for me. But you choose to use the first cause argument, and there are a variety of metaphysical arguments. Choose that one. And I actually think this, Ed Fazer has a book out, Five Arguments for the Existence of God, but it's very helpful.
It's a great book, by the way.
But it's very helpful to focus on one. And why did you pick first cause And how do you see that working in the minds of people who read the book?
Yeah, it's so funny because even St. Thomas himself says that all of his proofs ultimately are the same because the one implies the other. It's just different facets of the diadem, right?
Oh.
The reason I chose this one is because it seemed to me the one that's most easily graspable just by experience. You don't have to, you know, the argument from contingency, that's, boy, it really is a head scratcher if you don't have the precise definitions of everything correctly. But all of us can relate to the fact that if a leaf falls from a tree, something had to have caused that leaf to fall. A bunch of things had to be in the sequence of events that led eventually to the leaf falling, right? That sort of thought process to me is very, very simple and hopefully graspable by just about everyone.
Yeah, and your point is if you really think about that leaf falling, you go deep very quickly.
That's right.
You can't – there's no shallow answer. Well, I suppose there is a shallow answer that's dismissive. I suppose that people can always just dismiss. But if you kind of come at it with a sense of wonder about that leaf falling and sincerely ask about the just that leaf, you'll get all the way to the deepest possible thinking that you can do very quickly.
That's right. And I use two very simple examples that I tied to that falling leaf. All right. So the start is, well, a bunch of things we know had to have happened for the leaf to fall. We witnessed the leaf falling. So we know, for example, we might not know if it was, you know, just this change of the seasons or a nibbling squirrel or an earthquake. We don't know maybe necessarily why it fell, but we know that certain things had to be there in order for that leaf to have fallen. For example, there had to be a branch, there had to be a trunk, there had to be a sapling, right? And then to make the long story short, there had to be the earth, there had to be the source. And at some point, if we keep going back and back and back in time, obviously our knowledge of experientially of what those causes were, that knowledge breaks down. But it's okay. We can say something had to precede something, had to precede something. And we can know that with absolute certainty, like we know 2 + 2 = 4. Then the argument goes, actually I use two examples. I say, all right, listen. Let's say I ran here to San Diego to Catholic Answers from my house. And then Sai asked me, where's your house? And I say, it's infinitely far that way. You can instantly see the absurdity of that. I could have never gotten here, right? And then I brought with me a big plate of brownies. I said, I try these brownies. They're delicious. That's my wife's recipe. She says there's an infinitely long list of ingredients for these brownies. Again, we scratch our heads. No, that's impossible. The very fact that you're eating the brownie implies that however many ingredients, however many causes were necessary to bake the brownie, it couldn't be infinitely long list. Because no person can collect all those ingredients. You never get to the baking, nonetheless the eating. The very fact that you're biting into that chocolate brownie implies that it's an exhaustive list of causes. All of its causes are done. It's a finite list. The fact that I arrived at Catholic Answers implies that however long I ran, it couldn't be infinitely long. It had to be finite. Same with the leaf. The leaf fell, which means all of its causes have been exhausted. It couldn't be preceded by an infinitely long list of causes. It couldn't be preceded by an infinite amount of time or this amount of space because it's arrived, if you will, at its destination, which is the fact that it fell. And so if it's not infinite, the long list of causes, it has to be finite. And if it's finite, that means even if we don't know what it is, there had to have been a thousandth cause in the list of causation and a hundredth and a tenth and a third and a second. And eventually you get to a first cause. And then once you go deeper into that first cause, you realize, whoa, this first cause is radically different than everything that came after it. And that's how you get to God.
It's beautiful. I think the argument is, it's not the first time I've heard the first cause argument made, but it is beautiful to think to the way that you phrase it. I think it's very helpful to people. But then, okay, I'll go along with you, Leo. There is a first cause. There has to be a first cause. That first cause has to be different than every other kind of cause. But I can't know anything about it, Leo.
Yes, you can, Sai. You can know one thing for certain. You can know that because it's the first cause, there's no cause before it. If there was a cause before that, well, then it's not the first. It's the first effect, maybe, but that the one that came before, that's the real first cause, right? In order for it to be finite. Well, okay, then what caused that one? Oh, another one. Well, it caused that one. And you're back into the rabbit hole of infinity and infinite regressions, which we know is impossible because the leaf fell. So there's one thing we can know for certain. This first cause has no cause before it, which means this first cause, in order for it to be the first cause, has to be uncaused. Now, nothing in the universe is uncaused. by the very definition of the universe, we're living among things that are effects and that are causing things all the time. Just the progression of time, that the expanse of space implies causality. So if we can grasp the fact that this is a first cause, we can deduce with certainty that it is uncaused. Well, an uncaused first cause is crazy different than everything that comes after it. And from there, we can start listing a bunch of other properties. And that's what I do in the book.
And then you get to the point where you use our design, that is the way that we are, to talk about our purpose. Can you say something about that?
Sure. Yeah. Once we've concluded that life has a purpose, we're going to see ultimately, and obviously to those of us who have faith and who know a bit of our tradition and our theology and our history, that not only is that purpose knowable, the purpose is intricately linked to the design. But again, that's common everyday experience. You know the function of a thing because of a design. I'm sitting in a chair right now. Chair can be used for a bunch of different things. Right? It can be used to hold the door in place. It can be used, we can name a bunch of stuff. But we can know the actual purpose of the thing by its design, by the way it's shaped, by the way it's meant to accommodate curvature of the body and rest and et cetera, et cetera. Same with everything. Everything's purpose, we know, in fact, is linked to its design. The cell phone that I'm using right now to speak, it can serve as an amazing paperweight. But we know that's not its purpose because it has a design that makes it so that it can do functionalities that other things that are paperweights cannot do. We don't need to belabor the point. Everything whose purpose we know, we know because of its design. So if we want to know the human purpose, we need to look to the human design. What is it about us, humans, that makes us different in our design than everything else? Cheetahs can run faster, eagles can see better, mountains can take up more space. But I would say it's pretty obviously certain, and it's inductively certain, that we can outthink. One of the things that we can do is we can think. We can think better than anything out there that we know of, right? And in knowing something, our design has to do with knowledge, with the intellect. The other part has to do with the will, with choosing, with causing things in reality by choice. Those two things, I point out in the book in a more detailed way, those two things are particular to human design. And so if that's particular to human design and design is like the purpose, our purpose has to be to know, to choose, to be causing things in a certain way. And that's our purpose. And from there, the leap to God is again, another step that we take.
Going deeper, a reasoned exploration of God and truth is the book from Leo Severino. And I can imagine that people with sincere questions, this is a wonderful book because you can work through it logically. I was telling you before we started the interview, Leo, that I really like the chapter recaps. I think that's become common in a lot of books to do these little bullet points. But in your case, they're not just bullet points of here's things to consider. They are actual logical steps you can follow. So you can, literally you could start in chapter one and go through the book and follow the logical steps at the end of each chapter, and you would have a wonderful, succinct, and kind of reviewable argument for your purpose as a human being. Leo, after you've written a book like this, do you have a sense that, I've got this, I've made this argument, now I've got to, lead the horse to water to get him to drink, sort of. I guess I'm stuck on that idea it is a simple argument, not simple in the sense of being dumb, but simple in the sense of being followable. You can follow this argument. It's perfectly reasonable. It arrives at what we can say are true conclusions. And yet the world I anticipate will still maybe by disinterest not accept what you've said here.
Well, listen, if free will was such that you would hear a truth and instantly, all of your faculties would align to it, if that's the way it worked, I can't imagine why the entire world wouldn't be Catholic.
Right.
you're hitting on something that is far beyond my pay grade. All I can do is put this forward as best as I can and hope that it gets in the right hands and pray to the good Lord to handle that for us.
Well, I wonder if it is beyond your pay grade, though, Leo, because what I'm thinking of in asking you that is that you also are involved in artistic endeavors and that may be the other side of it. Like when you make a movie like Bella or Little Boy or the movies that you're continuing to work on, is there an element of trying to address the person in a different way that maybe overcomes indifference so that they can begin on that search?
Absolutely. No, it's wonderful. It's what we're trying to do with our film company. With Bella, we tried to put a film out there that made people think of life in a different way. And by God's good grace, you know, there's been plenty of babies that are now alive because their mothers, who otherwise, you know, were choosing other things, wound up seeing this film. And what we tried to do with life, with Bella, we tried to do with faith, with Little Boy. So, you know, you're right. That it's the way our Lord got most of his points across, right? When he was preaching, it was by parables, by stories. And I think, in doing so, there's something to be said, right? There's something that's a means that we need to explore to, I mean, literally there was a time when Catholics controlled, you know, the arts in the best of ways, meaning it just produced the best arts, and they had a moral say as to what was being filmed and what wasn't being filmed. And
right,
you know, it's not that long for those days, although I do. It's I'm trying to participate in whatever way I can to mimic
right,
you know, good Catholic art.
It's not like that when that it's now it's more open, like more there's it's in fact in Hollywood, I'll assert this and you can tell me if I'm wrong, but the control goes in the other direction, that there's large parts of our media kind of companies and productions involved being captured by a different ideology, an ideology that probably breeds indifference.
Not only indifference, a particular agenda that's hostile to everything that is, not everything, but much that is true and good and beautiful. No, you're 100% right. I was inside of it when I was having my conversion to the faith, and that was a crisis. That was a crisis that I had. Can I continue working in this industry? I was a pretty big studio at the time, actually one of the largest, and nonetheless professed my Catholic faith. And turned out that the answer to me subjectively was, I don't think I can, which is why we started our own film company, Metanoia Films.
And are you talking publicly about coming projects, or are they all hush-hush?
Yeah, we have one that we have a couple that are hush-hush, but one that I'm very excited about that I need to speak about because I need to implore everyone's prayers. And that is a project that is about the Herodian persecution in the first century, where Herod the Great, so-called, felt that his kingdom was threatened by the birth of a child and would do anything he could to exterminate the child, including slaughtering a bunch of innocent children in this town called Bethlehem. And the one thing that's in his way is a teen mother and her husband, and of course it's Saint Joseph and Our Lady, and the child is the King of Kings. And so the film is about that journey, that struggle from leaving Jerusalem to get to Egypt to save the life of the child, and then at the end of the film realizing they have to go from Jerusalem go from Egypt back to Jerusalem precisely so that the child could die. So it's a story where our Blessed Mother is a protagonist, and we've been working on it for some years now, and we've got some great theological minds, including Catholic Answers' very own Tim Staples, helping us to make sure everything's theologically sound and accurate. And we relied heavily on a lot of the visions of the mystics, including Blessed Anne Catherine Emmerich. But, you know, quite frankly, we don't know if our Blessed Mother would want a film done about her or done where she has a protagonist, you know, a role as a protagonist. And so we left it in her hands, wound up closing financing on the Immaculate Conception, which is coming up.
Wow.
So that's when we closed the financing, and then we actually got the rights fully to the film on the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. So right off the bat, there was some pretty good signs. And since then, she's been opening up all kinds of doors. So we're walking through them until she tells us not to. But I can implore everyone's prayers, please, for that project. That would be great.
Well, if you want to see Leo's work, you can see Bella or Little Boy. They're in all kinds of places. Wherever you can get movies, you can get those movies. And the new book from Leo Severino, Going Deeper, A Reasoned Exploration of God and Truth. Leo Severino, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Simon. Thank you for a great interview. Thank you for all your good work there at the Catholic Answers.
Oh, that's very kind of you. And thank to all of our listeners, thanks again for joining us on Catholic Answers Focus. Please share with your friends and neighbors that we do these podcasts each week. And join Radio Club. Just go to catholic.com/radioclub to become a Radio Club member. Then you'll know about and receive these focuses each week without missing any. Thanks again. This is Cy Kellett. This is Catholic Answers. We'll see you next time on Focus.